Meeting will come to order. We have a quorum. Madam Clerk?
We have a quorum with all members present.
Can we have Terry lead us in the pledge? Lead us in the pledge. Tonight we have a combination work session, and we do have two action items. One of the action items, A, is a board policy for first reading, and then the second item after we get done with our work session will be the budget. Is there approval of the agenda?
I move to approve the agenda as presented.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Is there any dissension? Agenda is approved. This takes us down to number three, action items. 11-, on the table here, you should have a copy of a proposed policy change. It's 11-157, board policy 5116, school attendance boundaries. Is there a staff report?
Thank you, Mr. President. For this meeting of the Mat-Su Borough School District Board of Education, we have this item. Board policy 5116, school attendance boundaries. There's really a change of one word, and that word is moving from will to may. This will allow the district some flexibility. As you know, and on your board meeting on April 20, you'll be considering boundary recommendations that I'll bring forward based on the work from our consultant and the staff, and then you'll be asked to vote on the changes by May 4th. So we thought it'd be good and timely to have this item brought forward. Dr. Palmer, you want to say anything else about it?
Unless there's any questions.
We have to take any questions?
Any questions from the board?
This is our first reading.
Of staff? This is the first reading for this.
Do we have any history about why this would be an issue?
Yes. Dr. Palmer, Mr. President?
Sure.
Absolutely. If you recall, when the opening of KNIC occurred, we had about 600 kids at Goose Bay. And when KNIC opened, some kids from Goose Bay would move, but also children from Snowshoe. And at that time, boundaries were taken and staffing was changed. And so there were 104 boundary exceptions or exemptions. In literature, both words are used, for students of parents who thought that, well, we want to stay at Snowshoe. Because staffing, no new students were added to the district, and so staffing is finite. So we found staffing from other buildings, moved them back to Snowshoe. As it turned out, those that were made really late stayed or continued to go to KNIC, even though they signed boundary exceptions. So then, within 5 days of the school year, we removed four staff members, highly disrupted a school, and moved them back. This helped with, I guess, the fairness of staffing for communities to know that they would have teachers. It encourages parents to come out early, and those that did come out early did stay. The latter ones that occurred during the summer didn't maybe think it through or weren't as eager, but they didn't. And so in order to provide the best staffing for all our communities at their schools at the time, we requested that the early ones we can plan for, we'll put them in your budget, but then we're not going to move during the summer staffing. And it was a large disruption. It actually came before the board. The board had a session at Snowshoe at the time. I don't know if you recall that, but it was a very major event. And so board policy was passed to work with principals to encourage parents to get them early if you wanted them. It doesn't mean we don't take them. Boundary exceptions are open throughout the year due to available staffing. Now, if a boundary exception is taken in October or 25 are taken in October, that doesn't necessarily mean staffing will be added to your building.
In addition, Mr. President, if I might, as you excuse me, take boundary recommendations from myself based on the work that's been done, it gives us more flexibility to create a problem that we've just solved. We can decide whether it's best to or not best to. So there are a number of reasons, and that's one of them. So I think that explains it.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Mayor Gaddis.
Yeah, I'm struggling. What, if I'm hearing correctly, we're changing a word from may to will, correct?
No.
Will to may.
Correct.
And I guess I'm coming from the standpoint of, if you will, school choice. As a parent, I realize that our schools are getting more and more crowded in some areas, and I can recognize the school district, but I feel like we're cutting off an avenue, and I guess tell me where I'm wrong, for parents not to use that boundary exemption when something is not working at a school for them. And I think that's real important to have that option.
Well, and we don't say it's cut off. The word simply is, rather than we have to, we may, and we'll take a look at all of the information. In most cases, we'll probably be able to move ahead as we have in the past, but we need the flexibility, particularly as the board will go through perhaps the arduous task of changing boundaries. We don't want to complicate the problem again. So it doesn't say will or won't. It says we may.
Well, since this is the first reading, you know, I'll do a little bit more homework on it.
And please call.
Yeah, I will.
Dr. Prom, anything else?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to mention, when Sarah asked her question, I referenced it as, what was the history of why it said will not? That is the history. Why? Because it didn't allow for the budget and the board to have the correct amount of staffing in each school, and it disrupted the beginning of the school year. However, we're desiring it to turn to May for more flexibility to be able to address those issues when parents do choose to move. And so I believe the new language will help meet your needs, but I might have misunderstood Sarah's question initially. I apologize.
That's how I see it, is it allows more flexibility with this new wording. Member Larson.
On a shared incident, this was put in afterwards, is that correct? This board policy was after the shared or snowshoe incident? The snowshoe moving of staff?
That is correct.
And what this policy says, you can't move staff after this period of time.
No.
With the will on it.
Basically, it meant that if a principal went out and got 60 extra boundary exceptions.
You won't move staff. With the will, you can't move staff or won't move staff.
Yeah, and some of the things that were also happening to just consider, principals would accept children into their school within a month after staffing, they would go back to their other school. And when there's a finite number of staff, when you're saying these kids are going here, that staff is coming from another building. So you need to look at, what other school are we going to take people away from, because they have signed boundary forms. And it just so happened that the over 100 signed forms that occurred in the summer didn't allow for the best planning, and it highly disrupted the students, probably 100 students at Kinnick who didn't have teachers, and four teachers or 100 kids at Snowshoe who were with teachers that had to be moved. And so it was just to meet the community needs to better plan administratively. That was the impetus at the time.
Can I just add one thing? We're also fortunate today that we have our first meeting with Radio Free Palmer. So hopefully this is reaching more than the audience that we have here. So I just want to let folks know that we're live. Member Gaddis.
Thank you. No, my question was going to be with online enrollment. Will we be able to react a lot faster? So these boundary exemptions, we won't necessarily just be looking at when school started, but we have that opportunity all through the summer to kind of prepare.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. Yes. We will better prepare by allowing the flexibility.
Any other questions? So this is first reading. This will come back at our next meeting for a second reading. Are there any members of the audience at this time that would like to speak to this item? This is a new item. You're going to have another opportunity at the next meeting to speak on this. But there is a copy of it back there, and it is just one change from will to may. If you're seeing none, we're going to move on to the next item, and the last item is the item B, 11-158 FY 2012 budget. And I'm going to anticipate and hope for a lot of questions, a lot of dialogue, so that we can get an understanding, if we don't already, on various items within the budget. This is a very important item. As has been told before, and I want to thank administration for really drilling through the data, making the data presentable in a manner that we can understand in different forms and different formats. We have a lot of unknowns. We're dealing with this budget right now and some on many knowns, but also a lot of unknowns. And just a reminder that the budget's being based on the assumption that there'll be no increase in funding across the board, because at this stage of the game, that's not assured. And there are a number of bills being moved through the legislature, hopefully that will help us with funding as well as other school districts. We also, as a school district, have some items in there that are specific to our district, such as you kept hearing the term fiber, which is fiber optics, in an effort to wire the school district, all the schools, so that we can deliver coursework and also staff development and some administrative work as well. And I think the communities will also be taking advantage of this. We just had our meeting last night with the borough, and so they've got a first draft, and we're immersed in this last night for the very first time. So we're kind of in the middle of the budget process, but we're nowhere near the end of it. So we're going to try and work through that. And so I think there's a number of board members that have questions on it, and this is an action item. So there will be audience participation when we get to that point. But I'm going to forgo the staff report, because we've had staff reports on this throughout the spring. So I'm going to open it up and for folks to just start to ask questions at the board level. Yes?
We did take all the questions which were submitted and prepared answers.
Okay. And do you have that on an overhead?
We do.
I knew it. Which means I have to move again. Okay, why don't we do that? There were questions submitted by the board in anticipation of this meeting. It's given staff an opportunity to lay those questions out. Maybe we'll get many, if not most, of our questions answered, and then I'm sure there'll be other questions as well. So I will move out of the way. Where is that? Which one is it here? It's in here.
So the format that we followed was the question will be at the top of each slide. That will be in black, and the answer will be in blue. Additional comments are in red. So the first question was, some of the members of the community are questioning the reduction in staff at the elementary level, including nurses and specials. How was this determined? Well, as we've mentioned before, we did use ratios. And the ratios were developed in conjunction with working with the principals and other staff members. And then we utilized those ratios to develop the staffing both for specials and some other areas. So that is how it was done. In your large budget document, all of the ratios were presented. The nurse staffing was determined also using ratios after meeting with the nurses for an extended period of time and taking their input to develop the ratios.
Mr. Forrest, will you state, in the case of nurses and librarians, how many actually would be affected by this reduction plan?
At the present time, there is one librarian position which would be removed and two nurses which would be removed, and there are two nurses retiring.
Question? Oh, yeah.
just want to be clear. I think I heard it, but we worked with the folks that are on the ground with this item. And how was the process? May I ask, how was the process received by the nurses that worked on this?
I think that they were. You know, if Scott's here, he can answer. Scott is the individual who did the negotiation with the nurses.
Hello, I'm Scott Doherty. I haven't met everybody, but thank you for listening. The process with the nurses was very simple in regards to we put an email out to all nurses to attend a meeting. We talked about the meeting. We talked about prioritizing health services in regards to everything from acuity of students that need intensive medical coverage to distance from medical facilities to the number of students to the difference between elementary nursing activities through high school nursing activities. And we came up then with a multiplier effect to have an adjusted student enrollment. And at that point, after the adjusted student enrollment, we put a metric down about nursing staffing. It was clear after the metric was developed that some schools had an abundance of nursing services. In a school like Wasilla High School that has nearly 1,300 students, could use some additional services. So using that, we came up with a number and we made some adjustments.
Thank you.
Member Cordero?
Through the chair, are schools like Swanson and Sherrod going to end up sharing one nurse, as originally mentioned?
Not at this time.
Okay.
And there will be some sharing of nurses. However, with the metrics developed, a site like Swanson and Sherrod or Kinnick and Goose Bay with over 900 children will not be sharing as much as a school like Butte, who has only 320 students, and Sutton that has 60. Okay. They'll be sharing.
Thank you.
Scott, you may just want to stay there for a couple.
I thought I'd get by this year without having to testify.
I want to wait until we get to the next question.
Okay, so
this is going to lead.
Are there any other questions for administration, Mr. Doherty, on this particular? We may end up. You're
right here. I'm going to sit closer.
Dr. Burnley may call you back.
Next slide, please.
Thank you.
Okay, just to point out, in this case, I did add the word staffing to ensure that the question stood on its own. Was this staffing a top-down decision, or was it site-based? Was it a site-based decision? Members of committee, staff, parents, administration, this is just a review of who was involved in the process. As described in the first slide, the allocation of specials was done through a formula. However, once the allocation was done, then each site was encouraged to use their own process to arrive at how they would deliver the specials program. And that varied from site to site as to how they made that determination.
Mr. President, if I might, is that clear to members of the board? And again, we have to remember we have a listening audience, so we have to be very explicit in our responses and speak into the mic. And Dr. Brahma, is there anything we'd add to what Mr. Forrest just said?
Just to support what he had said, when the work happened at the building, they were not only considering the programs, but also the teachers and the people in the programs. At many schools, some staff was taking part in the SERP, so they took that into consideration rather than perhaps cutting a teacher that was there, or they looked at the talents of the teachers, the skills of the teachers. How can we offer a library service, music, as well as physical education with our staffing that we have? And so they were building decisions principals used their leadership groups. They talked about it and then worked with Katie Gardner, our HR specialist, to make those recommendations.
And what is CERP?
The CERP is the Supplemental Entire Employee Retirement Program, which we instituted in an effort to reduce the amount of layoffs required to remove the structural deficit.
This allocation, this is just for specials, this question?
This question related to specials, yes, sir.
And that's library, music and gym?
Yes, sir.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you.
Next slide. We've partially answered this question, but the nursing staffing, especially at our two schools in Palmer, has been questioned. Since we have evidence based on scientific measures that we use for instruction and curriculum, are there any studies that support this as a best practices? The staffing model that is being proposed is not based on best practices. It is based on, as was previously indicated, the knowledge that was gained working with the nursing staff, also using the metrics, and then looking at the unique circumstances, as was mentioned earlier, of each building, since that varies dramatically in this district, from the very small schools, extremely remote location, to schools that are much larger.
I believe there are no best practices studies on nursing allocation. It varies from location to location, state to state, et cetera.
Correct.
Through the chair, didn't we have a doctor here about 3 weeks ago that said a best practice would be to have a school nurse in each one of our schools? And which leads me to another point, the next one we have here, about acceptable risk. Sioux Valley, Talkeetna, and Trapper Creek share the same nurse. How do you stretch a nurse 60 miles? And is it... what is the acceptable risk for all those children up there if we have to stretch one 60 miles? And while I'm on it, you said we had two nurses leave due to the CERP program. So does that mean that that school where those two nurses left does not have a nurse, or are we going to acceptable risk that? Please enlighten me.
Yes, there were several questions there. The first one in regard to services, certainly – we can speak with the principals and how it's been working up in Talkeetna, Trapper Creek, Willow, and Sioux Valley. They've shared nurses in this similar fashion for over 15 years. The sharing of nurses in the lower valley, if you will, isn't as dramatic as of distance as is up north. Another question was in regard to the study. The benefits of the nurses was tremendous in that study, to the fact that we were able to capture a BMI, a weight and height metric for students to be able to participate in the study and improve our health. And the working with the nurses and teams, as Mr. Doherty had stated, we have some, when we did the metrics, we realized that some schools, their nurse may actually have additional time to help others. And so we've actually facilitated Wasilla High gaining nursing services through a shared model based on not only the population of the school, the distance of the school, but also any particular medical concerns at a school. Also provided some metrics, but we believe that the collaboration of the nurses to understand where things might need to be helped, similar to taking BMI, we might have a team now of five nurses that could help with that for that study. So that's for us, that is going to help us be able to facilitate teams to do that. But she referenced having a nurse to be able to capture those data. And the third question was
the next slide, but I believe, to answer your question, part of the experience that is internal to the district already is what Dr. Paramo indicated. Many of these schools have shared nursing services previously for long periods of time and have pretty much demonstrated that it can work when used appropriately. That does mitigate the risk. So if you have good experience for shared nursing, it's really a good prognosticator, if you will, an indicator that that should continue in the future.
And the buildings, the buildings that did lose their nurses are not the ones that are going to be without nurses. It's all based on the metrics, again, used to determine the needed assistance.
I can appreciate your metrics and your math. That's great. And just because we've done it for a long time doesn't mean that it is right. I'm thinking about the children that might need a nurse that don't have one. And if we have an emergency, what's going to happen? It would appear that we consider that an acceptable risk of doing business. I don't think that's a good way to do business, and that's all I have to say.
Can I just for clarification, because I just want to make sure of something. There is or there is not a nurse being cut up there?
No.
Okay, there's not.
No. It's the fact that we have
okay.
one nurse for three schools. I believe we should have one in every school.
I understand. Okay, so that clarifies it for me. You're asking for an addition to that because of those. I get you. All right, I'm good. Member Gaddis?
I guess my question would be, as a new board member, I would need some clarity on what does a school nurse do? And, I was raised in Alaska, and we didn't have a school nurse, so I'm struggling with it when I hear Dr. Paramo indicate that, you know, we have a group of people that can, nurses, that can work with the BMI and these healthy things as a kind of a consortium, whatever. But so it leads me to wonder, in a school, what does a nurse do that can allow them to be shared from school to school, where the concerns where Board Member Lacey is concerned about? I just don't understand what the nurse's function is. Briefly.
Ms. Doherty.
Thank you, sir. Briefly, school nursing is, first of all, a safety net because Alaska doesn't have as much access to public health as other places in America. They do appropriate screenings, and that's why we figured in the metrics that elementary school kids are supposed to be screened more often than high school students. And the screening includes everything from dental health to height and weight checks to eye exams to all of that. The other thing is school nurses have a function for connecting wraparound services. So there was a, such as providing warm winter gear for our homeless population or the poor children. So there was a metric in there, a factor, excuse me, it's not a metric, it's a factor for our poor outlying school district or schools. So every title school got a multiplier that we took into consideration. They also act in the function of triage for when there's an emergency, and I agree with Mr. Lacey that there's emergencies every day at schools, but what the standard protocol is to call 911. We have children. When we talked with the nurses about acuity, everybody had diabetic students or students with seizures or whatever, and it still is when those things happen, when an EpiPen or a seizure, the majority of the call is a 911 call.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, what I'm hearing you say is that screening and nurses will look at some things that maybe clinics would do if they had them in their area, would be aware. So the emergencies and the issuance of their medications, is it necessary to have a nurse to do that, or in the schools where they have a traveling nurse that's screening and helping, with coats and whatever, is there somebody else that can give the medication if the nurse is not there?
Thank you for that reminder. One of the things that nurses provide is cross-training for staffs to provide emergency medical services, training for medications, all the other things. Because right now we have, I believe, 42 school sites, and we only have 30 nurses. So on any one day, there's 12 schools that have gone uncovered for as long as I've been around. The difference now is there'll be two additional schools, but I think that the sharing of nurses is an appropriate thing to do, and we've been doing it for the 20 years I've been in the district.
Okay, thank you.
Member Cordero. Thank you, through the chair. And one of my questions was actually asked by you. Are nursing services available to charter schools and to Mat-Su Central students, correspondent students, too?
Currently, Mat-Su Central School has a 0.4 nurse. It's part of the sharing process. The charter schools have configured nursing in different ways. Some of them have extended contracts to our current nurses to do the actual paper screening of shot records and stuff. Some people have volunteer parents that's part of their charter school commission that they would come in and do some of that screening.
And my last question is, are we required by state law to have nurses at the schools?
Please correct me if I'm wrong. I do not believe so. No. The answer is no.
Just Member Lacey, may I ask you a question just for clarification purposes? Assuming this is a zero increase now, and I'm thinking through what you're saying here, are you advocating nurses for those schools that currently don't have them up the valley? If money comes through, or regardless, because that'll make a difference in how we approach this. Because if money comes through, obviously we have time to see what that money is. But if we don't, then we would have to move things around within the current budget, assuming the assumption is that we would get no increase. I'm just wondering what your thinking is.
I would like to see a nurse at every school. And if it's a school that's a small school, that nurse could teach some classes and have a one FTE. I think we're sitting on a ticking time bomb, and it's been in 20 years in the making that we don't have a nurse in every school. And as a recipient of nursing services at our schools, when I was employed there, they're very important. As Mr. Doherty pointed out, they do screenings in the elementary schools. They look for child abuse. In the high schools, fights, bloodborne pathogens exposures, all kinds of bizarre stuff. I think we should have one in every school. That's all I'm
right, and no argument there. I'm just, once again, I'm just trying to think through the process, because as we go through this process, if we vote, for example, today to place a nurse at each of those schools, administration's got to think on where we're going to move those particular resources at this time, or they might ask us, are we going to do that now or wait to see what the budget is? That's all I'm trying to figure out, is how we're going to go about doing that. Member Larson, and then Member Cordero, and then Mr. Forrest.
We haven't discussed this up to this budget, and this budget's going to probably pass tonight one way or another. What I'd like to see is a long-term plan to address Mr. Lacey's issue, and I concur with him to as far as we can go. And the long-term plan is to look at new money through federal grants, or to look at a long-term, maybe put this into a long-term five-year plan where we might be able to add nurses as a program and utilize them as a health program. For instance, if we can extend the CTE health program down into the elementary schools, maybe we could utilize into the middle schools, we could utilize nurses for that, like he's talking about being part of the teaching staff. Who knows? I think what we need to do next year or through the summer is just take a look at this as possible program to add in the future. But right now, looking at this budget, you know, well, we know where we stand on the budget right now.
Member Cordero.
Mr. President, just to follow up on a comment that you made, I wonder how much does it cost in average for a full-time nurse?
If we're 12 nurses short, it would be $1.2 million.
$100,000?
Is $100,000 each.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Forrest, you had a comment earlier.
Yes, sir. As you move through the budget process, because this is a little bit different than perhaps the board has been used to, I would ask the board that if you are going to add items to the budget, that during that same discussion, you provide the administration with guidance on what it is you would like us to cut.
So what I'm doing as we go through this is I'm making notes, for example, the nurse issue that was brought up. Are there any more? Yes, Member Gaddis.
Well, since we ask what the average nurse is, what's the average teacher?
That is the same.
Okay, so they're both the same. So you, in this case, you could add a nurse but deduct a teacher.
Yes, ma'am.
Essentially. Okay, I understand.
Mr. President?
Yes.
That's salaries and benefits.
Yeah.
Yes, total compensation.
Right.
So in this, sometimes I get lost here. Quickly name the schools currently that do not, and when we say nurse, a nurse of any type, because correspondence has a 0.4, there may be others that have don't have a full FTE, but currently as we speak today, what are the schools that do not have a nurse stationed at their school?
Currently there's nobody that doesn't have a nurse stationed at their school. Sutton has 0.4, Glacier View has 0.2, Trapper Creek has 0.2, Talkeetna has 0.4, Sioux Valley has 0.4, Willow has 0.5. I'm just doing this off the top of my head. I can go back and get my folder. I didn't bring it up.
Okay. So I think what we're at, I'm going to have to ask to try and understand. Member Lacey, up the road, up valley, we're looking at a 1.0. Is that what you're advocating for? Full-time nurse at Trapper, Talkeetna, or 0.5, or?
I would like to see a nurse at every school we have. It's a safety issue.
Okay. Member Gaddis.
Just to be fair and balanced, if you will, what is, if we have a nurse at every school, then how many dollars are we extra are we talking about?
1.2 million.
So that 1.2 million equals how many more employees?
12.
12 employees, or that same amount could equal 12 more teachers.
Yes.
Got it.
Other questions regarding nursing at this point, because we're going to be here for a little while. Member Welton.
I just want to remind people that we have history of a period of time where we haven't had full-time nursing in the schools. When you only have 18 students, I believe Barry Ozova has what do they have?
Correct, and the 0.5 nurse at Willow actually does the
right.
Barry Ozova.
And I'm saying, what would the nurse do all day if everybody's been screened? Just to sit there and not all of our nurses have teaching certificates, and we could be in trouble to have them teach. I think that we're opening up a can of worms. I would like to see that we have healthcare at every school, so a person who is capable, and I don't want to devalue the nurse and the licensure that the nurse has and all of that. So I'm concerned that we're going to take 12 teachers out of classrooms. Right now, I think it's too muddy, and that over the summer, and I like Mr. Larson's ideas of really studying this as to what we could do and how we could make it better. I don't think it's something that we ought to be tearing apart this year. There may be other places in the budget later on that we want to look at tonight that need to be revamped as well. and that might be something that's seen as more important at this time. All of our students are important, and I'm not trying to put any of that down, so thank you.
Member Walton, it reminded me that we will have a nurse at every school at least 2 days a month, mm-hmm. and that's the important thing to remember, which is significantly more than lots of the schools that we have in the bush right now.
Okay, why don't we move on?
Next slide deals with, it's a continuation. It says, if we don't have certain things, basically what measures are being used to determine acceptable risk as it relates to nursing. Determination of risk is done at the site level. The specific needs of each site and their students is to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. Unfortunately, since the district does not have unlimited funding, risk versus cost analysis must occur on a continual basis at the site level. Decisions may be appealed through the principal supervisor, the assistant superintendent of education and instruction. So should a site feel that it is understaffed to meet the needs of its students or at a risk that is more than acceptable, they can appeal through Dr. Paramo. Next slide. Is there any hard data and not just anecdotal information related to nurse staffing? There is a significant amount of information related to nurse staffing within the United States. Alaska has somewhat more unique circumstances since the state has limited state, county, borough, and city health services. The district has also the experience of internally, as we've indicated, utilizing nurses on multiple buildings, since not all schools have school nurses. Most of the data that is available related to school nursing relates to the fact that school nursing outside of Alaska has been significantly reduced. So you may have a district the size in the number of students that we have here, with one or two nurses to service the entire population. Well, we keep data on these issues and problems that do occur to examine this practice. And examination of issues usually occurs immediately when dealing with issues related to student safety and services. If a trend starts to develop, then it would be appropriate for the district nurse coordinator and her team to notify their supervisors. So the answer is yes. If any trend starts to develop, that would be the same procedure that would be used, for example, in the H1N1 situation where we kept track, most of us in K-12, kept very accurate track of the number of students who were contracting the disease so it could be effectively fought.
It should also be noted that while we have a health, a nurse coordinator, I should say, they're overseen by a doctor in the borough. So if there are issues needing attention beyond a nurse's qualifications, there's a doctor on duty that, or on call that they can get a hold of.
What if we need to add staffing due to problems that occur? Do we have to wait a whole year? It is our practice to reserve within the budget emergency staffing that may be applied during the year. It is not uncommon to make small adjustments to staffing during the year, especially within the student support services area. So as the needs of students fluctuate, we have a small reserve which allows us to address the needs. The next slide starts to change a little. It says, how many minutes of instructional time for specials are currently at the elementary level, and what is the difference for the next year in the elementary schools who have lost staffing? The good news is that students lose not 1 minute of instructional time. Students continue to receive 225 minutes a week in specials. What are the cost savings for the 7-period day? Moving to a 7-period day has no impact on cost. The 7-period day is a methodology for dealing with reduced staffing at the secondary level. What is the downside, if any, financially? The 7-period day has no financial impact beyond the possible cost of additional supplies and materials associated with offering more courses to the students. What are the academic risks and benefits? Students will have between approximately 306 to 506 minutes less on each subject per semester. However, students will recapture these minutes in an additional subject. Therefore, students lose no instructional time. The risk associated with this activity basically is that students will have more subjects that they have to study for. Students will have the opportunity to take additional courses each semester, building a more comprehensive schedule, and more students should qualify for the Governor's Scholarship because their schedules will be able to include all of the required courses.
I have a quick question. So what if there are kids in high school that they've met all of the courses that they need? Do they have an opportunity? Is there going to be built in an opportunity for, in my day we called it study hall, where you go get your homework done, you don't want to take that seventh course, you just really want to get your homework done?
Dr. Prom.
Yes, Member Gaddis. There is a structured time, and one period throughout the week continues the same amount of time Monday through Friday, and not only students who are advanced or students needing extra time being taught or just want a study hall to do work, all of those options would be available. So for the gifted child who needs remediation. However, we didn't call it study hall. It's called academic enrichment time because sometimes study hall has a negative connotation with it. And so consequently, some of the teachers of AP courses and IB courses were concerned about students taking more courses and then not having the time to spend with them when they did see that that time could be used as an academic enhancement, not just for remediation. It was looked upon very favorably that time would be given within the student's day rather than homework at night.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that can a high school student only take six courses and the seventh hour, whatever hour that may be, they could have academic enrichment, which basically means it's not a course.
Actually, it would be an audited section, if you will. If a teacher was there to provide additional assistance, it may be an elective grade as just an elective that they may receive, because some of these will actually be reteaching where students are expected to get work done. I'm not exactly sure of the structure within the day. If it's just a place to go to study without supervision, that's not what I'm talking about. Yeah,
it's the without supervision. I didn't mean that. And I'll ask one more. And I have a nephew that's in high school right now, and he is not happy at me because he thinks he's going to have to take seven classes, and he doesn't need those seven classes. So is there an opportunity for him to take those six classes and opt out of the seventh one in an area where there is supervision and certainly to do your homework, or I guess leave early would be the other option, but
the plan is yes, there will be, and we are going to have a subcommittee that's going to continue the work and looking at how the structure of that day will operate. But to answer your question, yes.
Okay, I ask it. Thanks.
What areas have been found in the scrubbing of this year's budget that have been reduced due to inefficiencies or outdated practices or some other reason? The process that is underway is referred to as a business process review. The process began last fall and is designed to highlight areas where we may be able to improve. This evaluation has assisted us in identifying approximately 9 full-time equivalents, FTE, that could be saved through changes. The study is continuing. Not answered.
Member Walton.
It's not answered. You say you've saved 9 full-time equivalent, but you don't say where. And that was the question. And using the word scrubbing was a term that I believe you used. So I wish to find out where we are.
And the list was provided to you earlier this evening.
You came in late. Let's take a 5-minute break so we can get the list, ladies. Thank you. We're back in session, and we end it with a question from Member Gaddis to administration.
Member Welton,
I'm sorry.
It's
it. Thank you, Mr. President. I have seen information and understand that some resources are reallocated, and there has been some moving of the way we do things. Thank you.
Yes.
If I might add, what basically the business process review is attempting to do is to go through, look at the business processes, and determine if there are ways we can save positions, operational dollars, whichever is appropriate, so that they can be reallocated towards instruction. So in this case, all of these reductions are occurring outside of instruction. For instance, some of the things we've been able to look at is on the next slide, we talk about where we made investments. And so on the next slide, we say, are there areas that needed beefing up due to the quality of work or not enough hands to do the work? And in a perfect world, the business process review, it helps us identify where we should be redeploying our existing resources to increase customer service and improve effectiveness and efficiency. Due to budget constraints, we are reducing positions. But based on our analysis, we have added one programmer analyst position to improve our utilization of existing software. So this is a perfect example where we were able to make some adjustments in the payroll, accounts payable type area, and we can do that because we've already seen efficiencies that are being generated out of the information systems side of the house so that we can become more efficient in using software and services we already own.
Thank you. Any questions? I'm going to ask administration a question if the board at this stage. Dr. Burnley, if this budget is passed tonight by the board, knowing that the revenue picture is still in flux, when that revenue picture becomes solidified, knowing whether we will get additional revenue from the state and the borough, possibly the federal government, at that time, I'm going to make an assumption, and you can help me out here. We will reconvene in a meeting to review that revenue in light of the budget that we just, that if we pass it, the budget that we theoretically passed, so that we can have a discussion to deal with some of the items that are not funded.
Absolutely. In fact, that is the normal process. While this is a preliminary budget submitted to the borough to meet the timeline of April 1st, we often don't know what the legislature will do for several more weeks in the borough, sometimes at the end of May. So we always will come back, hold a board meeting, point out the additional revenue, and we certainly hope there is some. We'll have some recommendations, but it'll be a board opportunity to revisit the budget and distribute those dollars.
Thank you.
Next slide. With higher numbers of students in the classroom, what professional development is being done or will be done to ensure classroom management at all levels that is efficient and does not burn out our teachers? The district is implementing positive behavioral intervention strategies, PBIS. This is designed to ensure proper student behavior and improve school and classroom management. And Dr. Burnley or Dr. Paramo may want to.
Yeah, I think both of us would have a lot to say. We just sent myself and a few people to the National Conference on Positive Behavioral Intervention Strategies. It is a major national movement with lots of data behind it. And basically, will help us standardize how we deal with behavioral issues, how we incent students at schools. It has it's a major success and a lot of research and data behind it. So part of what we are wanting to do is standardize this practice across the district, so there'll be lots of professional development of our leaders and our schools, our principals, as well as the staff. Dr. Prama, you say anything else?
Just in addition to that, it works well in our general education classrooms, as well as provide supports for students who need more help to be successful. And so it's actually provided in a tertiary response, you know, what happens in the classroom, what can happen with counselors and additional service staff, nursing, you know, might help as well. And just provides the support not only to teachers but also to students to be successful.
even encourages schools to involve students in some of the decision-making process. So it has a good deal of research behind it, and the conference was outstanding. It was attended by hundreds of people from all over America. So when you think of response intervention, for those who are listening to us, there are three levels of response to intervention on the academic side. The general core population of our students need a standard set of interventions, but then some students need more, and at a third level, some students even need more, and that can include our gifted and talented students, who we really have to pay special attention to. Well, the positive behavior intervention side of the house has a similar kind of a style, but directly impacts how schools operate, even basic things like how to greet students in the morning, how to handle questions or issues on the part of students. So those are some standard ways of behaving that generate more positive response as opposed to, you know, turning young people off.
Yes, I was thinking more along the lines of actual getting instructional materials in more than behavior and discipline, and it is part of that program. I recognize from what I've studied on it and what I've seen. I just wondered, I was impressed by the videos I saw at the core last year of a teacher walking in and having control of a classroom and being able to do everything, and I just, you know, it's hard to teach that. How are we doing with that?
Actually, PBIS is part of response to intervention, and it starts with instruction, positive instruction, instruction that doesn't waste time, that is preventative. It gives kids the knowledge of the expectations. Routines help that, especially in the younger grades where there's a routine. So when kids know what's expected and a routine is taught to them, there's generally less disruption in the classroom. So response to intervention, if you will, has an academic strand. It has a student engagement and motivation strand that we have to pay attention to, as well as a management strand, and all together that is taught through instruction. It is part of the core academics of instruction. So you're absolutely right.
And you're asking how? Through lots of professional development.
Thank you.
How much is that costing us? The estimated cost next year is approximately $250,000, and we are requesting outside funding for support for these expenditures through grants, the borough, and the legislature. What is our rate of burnout now? Do we have any numbers? It's difficult to determine, especially since class sizes are relatively low. Human Resources reports that as of today, they are not aware of any reported cases of burnout. So at this point in time, we don't have any evidence that would indicate our teachers are getting burned out. Of course, class sizes have not increased yet.
Raise an issue based upon that statement, which is, I think, important. As some of you know, I work with the Alaska Statewide Teacher Mentor Project, and we do an incredible amount of data gathering and research. And what I'm about to say will be no surprise, but I think it needs to be taken into consideration in light of a tightening situation that we have next year. What we're finding in our research is that oftentimes new teachers, their classrooms are, for lack of a better term, and not to be inflammatory, stacked. In other words, we're all individuals, and there are some of us that are higher maintenance than others. And as a result, just looking at pure numbers doesn't necessarily tell the tale of the personality of a classroom. So what we're finding in our research is that new teachers, for whatever reason, end up oftentimes with low-performing students, sometimes scoring 20 or 30% below their peers in a classroom next to them. So I think your burnout factor is going to be difficult to determine until the personality of the class reveals itself. And I think, though, that the personality class, at least from a student achievement perspective, can be dealt with up front with a conversation with principals and others. And I know that there's oftentimes a selection process or a preference process, not just in our school district, but across the state, across the country. I just think that practice needs to be looked at in light of what we're going to be dealing with if our classrooms are going to increase to the degree we believe they may if we don't get additional revenue. So the demographics of that class, the student achievement issues of that class, and the other aspects that go into the makeup of a personality of a class, I think really need to be looked at in order to make sure that that class is set up so that the children succeed, but also so the teacher succeeds in doing what they're supposed to do. I can't stress that any more than I just did. Member Gaddis.
I hear what you're saying about the stacking, but there's one more component. And as a parent, we requested certain teachers. Either we knew those teachers, we knew that they were best for our kids, or quite frankly, there were times when we knew, and it wasn't just myself, it was other parents, we knew that this teacher really probably shouldn't be teaching elementary school students or whatever. So that component, I think, should also participate in. You know, parents should have that choice.
And I'm merely saying that all factors should be considered for the sake of children and for the sake of teachers. Thank you. Member Larson.
This question, I guess, is to Dr. Promo. Is it true that the principals do weigh that parent request? I mean, they don't. How they? Can you explain that?
It is absolutely weighed. Many times it's handled differently in the different schools. At some schools, there is no teacher requests, and the principal guarantees that your child will have a good education. If there's a concern about a parent that perhaps had an older child or just some concern with a particular classroom, they're invited to speak with the principal, and the principal can mitigate, you know, some of those issues. Other schools have a set limit on classroom requests. Also, there's a time limit on them that if they come out in similar to boundary exceptions, if they come in after a time limit, they might not be guaranteed. If you recall, we actually had a board member who had her child's class had about 33 children in it, 34 children, but the class next door had 26. That was due to a result of parent requests, and the teacher felt that it was okay to accept more students in the class, and they worked well. And so sometimes we do look at all issues, and we could have said, nope, all classrooms are going to be equal, but then those that wanted the requests wouldn't have been met. There's just lots of issues that go into it, so they're handled at buildings differently. The biggest way they're handled is through a percentage that we can guarantee. That's how it's been. But we've had a lot of principals understand exactly what Mr. Dunleavy, President Dunleavy, suggested, that, you know, we sure need to impact these to be sure that all kids are getting an excellent education and the best opportunity to learn. Therefore, we would not stack a classroom where that may not occur.
And I think we've kind of struck stumbled upon one of the issues that we have to deal with as an entire system, and that is the interplay between politics and best practices. And if we're looking at eliminating a structural deficit, we've gone through a SERP. Chances are that if we do replace folks that have left, they would be newer and younger teachers because of the expense factor. When they come into our schools, our parents don't know them. This is how this works. They know the teachers that are still there, and most often they'll request teachers that are there. Sometimes they won't, but the point is I'm trying to make is your new teachers, just like your students that need the most help, your teachers that are new need the most help. We just have to ensure that when we put that class together, that is it's a process that is there to help all succeed, and that we just keep that in mind.
And that we behave, those of us that work within the system, that we behave in the same manner as our parents who do not work within the system. And that is a high regard spoken to by principals as well, that because we work for Matsubara School District, that if we're asking for fairness and transparency, that we too follow that with our own children.
Are there studies of other districts where the PTR, pupil-teacher ratio, is high? There have been numerous studies related to class size and the impact on both student achievement and teacher stress. It is difficult to associate most of these studies to individual classrooms, schools, or districts due to the extreme diversity of each situation. To make a dramatic impact on student achievement, class size must be much lower than our current class sizes. So as Mr. Dunleavy pointed out, the studies are generalized, but it's difficult to take a study from a specific area and apply it to any given classroom or school district because each school, each classroom has its own unique identity, and so it can vary greatly. Obviously, we've heard the studies of how students in other cultures, for example, where the children perhaps don't behave like American children, they have much larger class size and still have great success. So it's just a difference in culture. Are there studies of other districts where the pupil-teacher ratio, PTR, is high? Studies have recently begun on the impact of rising class size among certain levels related to teacher stress levels in California and other states where class sizes are becoming extreme. Even with the increase in class size proposed, our district will not approach the extreme levels being reported elsewhere. California Ed Code specifies these maximums as an example. 33 in kindergarten, grades 1 to 6, 32, grades 7 to 12, 39. The California Ed Code, due to their catastrophic fiscal situation, is actually being reviewed for increasing these maximum class sizes as an indication.
I feel compelled to mention something. This is, once again, it's a crucial issue. There was a question or a statement made earlier in the presentation that what do we do? Do we hold money back in reserve in case we need to place resources when things materialize in the fall? If in fact, well, if worst case scenario pans out and we don't get any resources, additional resources, and if this budget goes through as presented based upon no increases, and if there are pressures building within classrooms because of the size and the demographics, we have to be prepared to have a, for lack of a better term, a release valve for those families. For example, we may have a number of folks that want to attend our Matsu Central School because the fit at the time, because of the numbers or whatever, teachers that folks have been familiar with, that their families have dealt with, are gone now. We just have to be prepared for that, because if we aren't prepared for example, our Matsu Central School to have the resources to take these children in, there are competitive models that exist in our district boundaries but are actually not part of our district that will be there to take advantage of that situation. So I just think we need to be aware of what could happen as these class sizes increase and how we need to figure this out so that we're still able to educate our children in our school district.
Are there any plans for paraprofessionals as helpers in larger classrooms? And due to the high cost of paraprofessionals, the answer is no. I provide a comparison between the cost of an average teacher in our district, total employee compensation cost for a teacher, not including the on-behalf-of payment by the state, is about $105,000. You compare that to the average cost of an individual who might be classified as a paraprofessional, and you can see that it's right at $69,000. So at the present time, due to that high cost for a paraprofessional, we are not considering that.
We have a question.
Actually, it's not a question. I'm needing to be excused. I wanted to make a statement before I leave. I want to first thank the staff for working so hard on this budget. We've been looking at this budget for probably 4 months. It's been something that's been in the works for a long time. I'm well aware of this budget that's been put out, and I agree with it. It is the worst case scenario, and until we find out how much money we're getting from the legislature and from the borough, I support this. And then with the ability to go back in and look at it if we do get more funding. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next slide. Please explain the use of subs. Substitutes are used to take the place of a classroom teacher who will not be in the classroom during an instructional day. We expect sub usage to decline for professional development with the changes to the teacher contract, which allows us to pay per diem rates for after school and Saturday professional development. As the board may recall, this was negotiated into the last contract. We think this will have a great impact on keeping teachers in front of kids. Is this a district encumbrance or a site-based issue? Substitute costs are controlled at the district level in total. How many subs, on average, are working in the district on any given day and the amount of money involved? If you turn to the next slide, we've done an analysis of substitutes. This slide shows you from the fiscal year 2006-07 through the current fiscal year, which I would like to remind the board is not over, so it's just the data through a couple days ago. And it shows you how the leave is distributed. If you go on to the next slide, there's actually a table that talks about it. So you can see that last year, 48.7% of substitute usage was related to sickness. This year, so far, we're at 45.9%. Last year, 25.4% was related to other than being in the classroom, but administrative. So this is where your professional development will be. This is where working in another position would be. So it's those things that the district has some control over, which is taking teachers out of the classroom, so 25.4%. Then annual leave, personal leave, non-contract leave, flex time, comp time, and floating holidays were 18.3% last year. They're running 17.8% to date. Extracurricular activities last year, 4.1%, this year, 4.2%. Other, which is truly undefined, and we're going to need to review that and see if we can lock the subsystem down to eliminate that category, was 0.8% last year. It's 1% this year. Jury duty, workers' compensation, emergency, and medical leave, 0.9% so far last year and this year. And union activities, 0.8% last year, 0.7% this year. Oh, sorry, I forgot without pay, 1% last year and 1.3% this year. Moving on to the next page, it's a graphic representation of which days of the week leave is taken. I'll point out that Sunday and Saturday, those absences only occurred in the first two fiscal years. It appears there may have been a problem. That problem appears to have been corrected, but I left them in so that the data is has integrity. Moving to the next page.
Question, Member Lacy. Sorry. Yes, on those Friday leaves, does that account for all the sports teams and such, the co-curricular activities?
Yes, it does. So as you can see, the percentages are given on the next page. And Friday is the highest across the board, but as was pointed out, there are activities related to student activities that occur on Fridays, which drive that number up. We're going to be doing a more detailed analysis as we go through and have more time. The next chart down below answers the question as to how much did it cost in total. So you can see for last fiscal year, we were accounting for 1,119.29 certificated personnel. This year it's up a little, 1,157. The cost of substitutes last year in total was $4,000,000. $22,000. This year, we're already at $3,050,000. The certified sub days used last year was 21,427. So the average sub days last year per certificated person was 19.14. This year, so far, we're at 15.27. And the average substitute cost without benefits, about $187.72. If you move on to the next slide, it does show by category what the costs are. I'll just do last fiscal year. Last fiscal year, SIC cost the district approximately $1,958,000. Professional development and other activities outside of the classroom, $1,021,000. Personal annual, non-contract leave, flex time, comp time, floating holidays, $737,000. Extracurricular, $165,000. Other, undefined, $32,000. Without pay, $40,000. And jury duty, workers' compensation, emergency and medical leave, $36,000. Union leave, $32,000.
We also, Dr. Primal, working on the notion of permanent subs. In other words, creating more opportunity for continuity and instruction by perhaps having a building have on duty a full-time substitute that can rotate between classrooms that know the children, know the building.
Yes, we've worked with some of those models already, especially when we do our testing. We bring in retired teachers and other folks with bachelor's degrees to be trained. And when we do our testing, they go in teams and rotate around. When our special education teachers need to have a sub due to an IEP during the day, generally we'll have the same sub in the building, as Dr. Burnley mentioned, so that they know the children, they rotate between the teachers that might need to go down to the IEP meeting and such. We've just tried to teach our subs and move forward in the things like AIMSWeb and our Promethean boards and offer training in our reading programs to help with the continuity of learning that goes on in our classrooms when someone is out of the building.
Mr. President, could we hear from Katie Gardner, our Human Resource Director?
In looking at the budget and the possibility of layoffs, one of the ideas that we have started to explore is rather than laying off certified teachers who are interested in working with the Mat-Su School District, is having them continue to be employed as permanent subs. What we are finding difficult with that is that there is a significant difference in the cost of a teacher versus the cost of a sub. So where we may be able to offset with the budget based on some of these expenses that you're looking at, I'm not sure that we will be able to have permanent subs in all of our buildings just because the cost associated with permanent employment is significant and a lot higher than what you would find with a substitute currently.
Thank you.
Yeah, we are exploring perhaps other models where the permanent sub is not, it's what Dr. Burnley indicated, that we have a relationship built up. Now, currently in the subfinder system, which is what we use to dispatch substitutes, there is the ability for schools to request a substitute. And so we're looking at exploring how we might be able to have substitutes who would fulfill that, as described by Dr. Burnley, that permanent type role. In addition to that, we are investigating, as one of the efficiencies in, that we has been uncovered, if you will, through the business process review, is that our substitute system is not tied to the human resource system. And so that's high on the list to ensure that all absences are tracked appropriately and correctly.
Continue.
Why are we using people who do not have a college education? As per board memo number 07-120 dated March 7, 2007, it was recommended that the administration be allowed to utilize non-degreed personnel due to the fact that the district was unable to recruit sufficient numbers of degreed personnel. And I may, if I might, have Ms. Gardner talk about where we are with the sub pay and what has transpired over the last few years.
In 2007, the district took to the board and was approved a differential pay structure for individuals who have degrees and individuals who do not have degrees. So since 2007, we have been trying to incentivize individuals who have a college education in coming to work with the school district. And so there is a higher wage paid to those individuals who are working in the classroom who have a college degree. In addition, our substitute dispatch system, known as the Subfinder system, does have a three-tiered method for calling substitutes when there isn't a sub-preference noted for a specific individual. The system will first call those individuals who have Alaska teaching certificates. It will next contact individuals who have college education's degrees, and then it will call other individuals who are interested in subbing. Part of our recommendation in 2007 for a differential in pay was also to limit having only degreed people working as substitutes in the district in the classroom. We tried that for a very short period of time, and we had a significant number of classrooms where a sub couldn't be found. And so what the schools ended up having to do, because you have to have coverage, they would find someone who was reliable, who was in their building often, and they would ask that person to do that. We also had some feedback from individuals who felt a little bit devalued in having provided service to the district as substitutes on a very reliable basis, having done it for a long time, very much enjoyed that work, and then they were no longer able to continue to do that because of they're not having a degree. So based on those two primary factors, the district did back off and say, we're going to keep our preference, and we're going to keep our three-tiered preference so that we can have degreed people as much as possible, but it wasn't something that we could facilitate practically to make sure that only people with college educations were working in the classrooms.
Question. Member Welton.
Thank you, Mr. President. What kind of training is being offered for the subs, and are there any evaluation processes going on? Just curious, because I know some people who do subbing, and I'm kind of concerned.
We do some specific training where substitutes at their election will learn how to use a Promethean board, some of those types of things. We have a substitute class that we encourage individuals to participate in that relates to substitute basics. And we do provide a $5 a day incentive for individuals who complete that course. The course hasn't been offered in a couple of months because of interest, and we're selecting a new instructor. But that is a course that is designed on a curriculum from Utah State University, who has what's called the Substitute Institute. The other part of your question regarding evaluations, we don't have an evaluation where every substitute is annually given feedback regarding their performance. It would be very difficult for principals to accommodate that. And it wouldn't be very practical, particularly for those individuals who only sub very rarely. And they don't have a single individual that they necessarily report to. What we do have is what's called a site exclusion request. So any principal at any time who has a concern regarding a sub's performance in their building, they submit what's referred to as a site exclusion. And then we review each of those exclusions on an individual basis. If it's a problem at that building where we think that there was a concern that just means that person shouldn't be either allowed at that grade level, allowed at that school, then through the system we can exclude that person from being able to sub in that area. If someone has multiple exclusions, we'll remove them from the list and not allow them to sub at all. Or if the reason for the site exclusion is very egregious, then we'll remove that person from eligibility to sub. So there's not really an evaluation, but there is that process in place by which principals can give us feedback on concerns that arise regarding substitutes.
Thank you.
Is there any incentive to have perfect attendance when not ill? No. However, teachers may cash out up to 3 days of personal leave each year if they don't use it. The request for the borough to fund our non-recurring instructional improvements or program concerns. Why the $300,000 for a dance path? I thought that the money was paid by the contractor. In order to expand the opportunities for kids, we are requesting additional funding to pay for items not included in the standard advanced path model. These include summer school, Saturdays, math after school, and students over the age for which we receive funding.
Member Gaddis.
Could I go backwards to the sick leave or and personal leave incentive? If I'm hearing you correctly, they can cash out for 3 days only, and is there any extra days that they can't use?
Well, they also get to accrue their sick days, and then as they retire, that is a benefit to them when they retire under the Alaska retirement system. So using your sick days actually counts against you in the long term, because you can boost your retirement by having those sick days available.
I guess where I was going is so that you really have to wait until you retire.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yeah, not the three. You can cash out the three every year.
Tier three.
Oh, that's no longer available.
I keep forgetting tier three.
Okay, can you say that all over again?
Tier three for teachers, tier four for classified is no longer a defined benefit, it's a defined contribution. So a defined benefit plan is where both the employee and the employer contribute to retirement, and then you have a life annuity. A defined contribution is where the state and the employee contribute to the equivalent of a 401k. It's a 401a in this case, and the 401a is portable, goes with the employee, and there is no benefit. You can't turn anything.
And the sick leave issue is governed by the state.
Yes.
It's embedded in law. The personal leave can be negotiated and discussed within the district. I have a question on advanced path. It's a simple one. So if we don't use the $300,000, we still get the standard advanced path in which the contractor, through the student account, gets their money for the services, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Member Cordero.
So outside of those $300,000 currently, what is the expenditure for advanced path for the whole district in total for the current year? And is that money coming from the contractor, or is that being taken from the budget somewhere else?
Well, we don't have the total expenditure by the contractor, because they made capital improvements, which are part of the contract, and we don't have those total expenditures. However, we are, as a district, have some general fund contribution when the required attendance drops below 95, I believe, per site. And we have had some attendance issues that drop it below that, and therefore we're actually paying a little bit for advanced path now.
Essentially, Ms. Bennett.
Is it attendance or enrollment?
It's participation.
Okay.
Essentially, I think the question you're asking, where does the money to fund advanced path come from? It comes from the student allocation that we get from the state primarily, and then the increases that he just mentioned, and then the other things we've asked you for here. So here's a program that the contractor, in this case advanced path, put approximately $250,000 to $300,000 of their own money in three different sites. So we've just about $1 million was given to the district. As long as they work with us, those upgrades and so forth stay. So on the capital side, it's totally a plus for a win-win for us. And on the operating side, we're essentially using dollars we receive from the state, so we continue to win there. And we're trying to get those costs to totally cover everything, except for the four or five additional things that we think would make it even better. So this is just a winning program, simply because the person who is the CEO used to run Plato, and works with leaders around the country that have money that want to invest in not something for profit, because obviously there's not a profit here, but they're wanting to make a contribution to education. They see this as a program that works, and so they're investing in it. I believe last year you might have raised $14 to $15 million from the private sector, so we're benefiting from this.
Thank you.
I might add that the other benefit that exists is that there is a high probability that some of the students who are participating in Advanced Path would not have come back to the district. So we received the state revenue, which otherwise we would not have received.
It's an alternative approach to a classroom. Member Larson.
The $300,000, is that part of that list that we're looking for if we do get money? Or is it $300,000 in this budget right now for that?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. We don't.
Yes, the $300,000 was specifically placed on a request from the borough due to, I guess, the community interest. Many of the students that we are hear about the program now, you know, the count period's over, they're hearing from their friends, seeing how successful it is. They want to come back to school and get a diploma. Many of these children are 19 years old. At that point in time, having it been after the count time, money allocation is not provided for these students. However, we would not turn a student away. But the best placement for a 19-year-old who needs to take Algebra 1 is not necessarily in a freshman Algebra 1 class. Therefore, we want to offer the best placement where the children will be most successful, even the 19-year-old children, to be most successful. And many times, that autonomy of like a workplace environment is the best for older, mature children. But again, we don't receive the BSA money because they came in after the count period. And so this would allow us to continue to help our community by pulling in kids who may have dropped out who are over age.
Last year there was a discussion in the legislature, I believe it was last year, to try and lengthen that time because the count goes, it's a 30-day count. And after that, students can come in or out and you neither lose money or gain money. There was a discussion last year trying to lengthen that almost to the first semester, but it's disappeared. Member Gaddis.
I'm struggling with this advanced path, and I'll tell you where I'm coming from. Just on my way tonight, I have a friend that their kid's not going to graduate. Anyway, the long and the short of it is he tried advanced path. He was in hockey. He didn't know that AWSAW, because advanced path only allows you to take two courses at a time. AWSAW, I think, is five courses at the same time. So it's not working for some of the kids that want to still do sports. I guess where I'm struggling, and I don't know, sometimes when you talk to people that are disgruntled and not, they've got teenagers, there's other issues. But is there a way that we can get a report about the students that came in, the students that came out, the students that came in late, the students that are looking at, I mean, I'm struggling with trying to determine if this is, and it's a new program, so I want to give it a chance. I think in theory, I really like what I hear, but and I'm not necessarily liking what I hear on the street, so.
Absolutely, that can be done. And interestingly enough, we worked with AWSAW on another student. The students in Advanced Path are enrolled in 4 to 5 courses. They're just taking a few at a time. So we have actually worked with AWSAW this year of the students who made the request and we knew about to get those provisions. So we have had students play basketball who are going to now run track. So we've actually worked and mitigated some of those circumstances, and many times the students did have to engage in more coursework or it motivated them to work faster. But we've taken a look at those instances that we've known about and worked with AWSAW.
As President Dunleavy said a minute ago, it is another option to give students a chance to move through our system. And as we're talking about some students needing more time, a different strand, this is another one of those opportunities. It's not for everyone. But then AWSAW didn't know how to recognize this. Now I think they have a better idea. So in some cases, we have to be sure at the counseling level that we properly advise students. If you're an athlete, then we need to make sure we appeal to make sure that they understand while you're taking two courses at a time over the course of the semester, you might even take more than ASA's recommending. So sorry about that. If it's happened, we certainly can address that.
We can provide your request, how many courses were completed in a quarter, how many students came into the program, how many exited, things like that. We could certainly prepare a report on that every quarter for the board packet.
And in the case, excuse me, Mr. President, in the case of this student, it'd be good if we got a name name
and
to follow up, see if we can fix that.
Right, or not. I just knew it coming in, so, you know, I just found out. But I am very interested in just, I know it's a new program. We have to give it a chance. It's a great program in theory, but how are we doing, I guess?
I think it'd be interesting to see where the customers are going and if they're staying. Member Cordero.
Is an increase in funding for this and those things that are on the list, would that also require additional staff? I mean, I realize that the program is computerized, but would that require personnel if there's an increase in enrollment?
No personnel increase based on the model we have now.
Okay.
However, if we're doing something over in the summer, I think we even plan on charging in the summer, okay, for students trying to make up credits, so there's no real cost there. Our cost overruns occur when students don't attend, and that's going to encourage us not only attending there but looking at all of our programs. This is a win-win for us in every way you can imagine, but believe it or not, like every other class, students have to be there, have to show up, and they punch in.
Okay.
So we're working with Advanced Path. In fact, just today, Carol Como and her deputy came here, and we visited Wasilla and our charter school, American Charter, to take a look at Advanced Path in addition to Career and Tech. So we have some programs that people are paying attention to and thinking about implementing in their districts.
Okay. Thank you.
Quick question on that. Dr. Burnley, would you consider Advanced Path to be a class, an approach, a totally different program? How would you classify it?
I'd classify it as a program that has multiple class options. That is an alternate way of giving students a chance to be successful.
Could it stand on its own outside of a school building? Theoretically, could it stand on its own in a district office or somewhere else?
Oh, I think so. I think it could stand on its own in a number of ways, but the model, the company, likes to partner with school districts, utilizing school district staff, including unions. So whatever we do, they want to be a partner within the school district and offer another option as opposed to putting it in a mall or some other concept.
Right.
That's just their preference.
And I'm just trying to see where it fits in the scheme of things when you have Mat-Su Central and you have Wasilla High and you have your charter schools and you have would you say Advanced Path is – I'm just trying to understand. Separate from those, is it a class? Is it embedded within that? That's why the question was: could it happen in the district office, away from a school? I'm just trying to understand a little bit better.
It certainly could. That's not their preference. I think what you were just illustrating or listing, it's another option, another program within our school district that gives parents and students yet another way to be successful. And I think that's what when the model we're talking about, transforming the school system, and some students needing longer to get through our system, some students needing a shorter period of time, they're going to need as many different ways to accomplish things as we can provide, and we can do efficiently and effectively.
Okay, thank you. Member Gaddis.
I'm just wondering, in that report, I thought I heard something that if we have lower than 95 students, that there's a higher fee that we pay?
Ms. Forrest, would you answer that, please?
Yes. In fact, they've submitted a new contract, and we're going through what that will look like for FY12. We've not had an opportunity to do that. But it is based on participation level by site.
I guess what I was going to ask is, could we get those fees as part of that report? You know, how much more we had to pay versus... I mean, I know it's a brand new program, but...
Well, we certainly can provide what we're doing now. What we're examining for next year, we're also saying, or they're saying to us, well, you know, if you don't think you can hit a certain attendance percentage,
right,
would you be willing to take a risk for us? And so make and set the attendance percentage lower and then charge you more money. So we're looking at any number of ways to make this work for us before we sign the contract for next year.
So as part of the report, that not only the students coming and going, but the cost of that too. Great.
I should say yes.
Just to follow up on that, there's a cost. There's a contract menu then with this outfit. In other words, 95 kids or more, this is the charge. 95 or less, so it's a menu basically.
Well, it's actually pretty complicated, and so we'll get the reconciliation done on the cost so you can see it. But it's directly related also to the staffing at each site. So it's a revenue piece, it's an expenditure piece, it's a staffing piece, it's an attendance piece.
Okay.
His chair is longer.
Oh, I'm sorry, Member Larson.
Advance path is generally for a lot of times for kids that are falling behind. Is that correct? Kids that have dropped out of school and coming back, that kind of, is that correct?
Yes, that was the target initially, and that's what the company, that's how they started. However, their software they use, the majority of it is APEX, which is the only online software approved by the College Board for AP courses, and it is quite rigorous, and so we have identified courses for which our advanced students or students that just choose to get ahead to clear their schedule so they can take, you know, two musics or more athletics or what have you, more sciences. We've narrowed those down to about five courses that students pay money to go to BYU or to take some other course to get ahead. We want to offer those courses for a charge at the summer school, so our students are taking our courses in our schools to get ahead. And so that's just an option rather than just doing an independent study where they can actually go online and have that interface with the teacher as well. So yes, the company started that way. That's how we started. However, we found another avenue to allow students more choice. And we have some interest this summer in students taking, we're going to cluster those about five different courses if they'd like, at $84 a half credit to get ahead.
So it's twofold now, or it can be twofold, and it can pick up from there. I'll make a statement which I've made before over and over again. Looking at in my other board, parole board, looking at parole packets, I look at the education, and generally most of those people have dropped out of school in the 10th and 11th grade. They fall behind, they drop out of school, they eventually get their GED, but usually they get that in prison. So if advanced pathways can cause the other board that I'm on to have less clientele, that would be a good thing.
Next slide. We told the borough we would not ask for more funds, and here we are asking for some $5,085,000, including transportation. These are program needs and not on a per pupil basis, which has been questioned as problematic by charter school advocates as inequitable. How is this fair? Our proposed funding methodologies for charter schools will be covered in later slides. Our charter school funding methodologies have been reviewed by council, and they are within the statute. These specific requests may or may not apply to charter schools, depending on the funding model they choose.
What does that mean?
You will learn in subsequent slides, I hope.
Just be patient is what you're saying.
Please. Regarding the cost breakdown for all schools, including charter schools, will administration be proposing to charge charter schools fees for admin services? During the board work session conducted at the Administration Center on March 4th, 2011, we provided samples of charter school budget worksheets and discussed whether or not the board was comfortable with pursuing alternative funding models for the charter schools. During this presentation, we presented a sample of the alternative methods and indicated that the anticipated additional funding that may flow to charter schools would be between $300,000 to $600,000. Continued on the next slide. Administration has continued the investigation into proposed alternate methods, which we believe to be a fair model for all concerned. Administration has had council review the current method, the contract method, and the proposed method. All three meet the state legal requirements. Under the proposed method, administration will charge for services rendered. Administration has met with representatives from charter schools to go over the proposed alternative funding method and offered to present to each school's board if requested. Administration has ensured all charter schools that the proposed funding method is optional and that the current method will be maintained should a school not wish to utilize the proposed funding model. Work continues on the model. Coordination with the charter schools continue. Under the proposed model, borough revenue is distributed differently, and administrative costs are charged in accordance with usage. For example, Board of Education costs are considered mandatory and charged at 100% on a per-pupil basis for all sites. Why is this? The board administers all schools within the district. Therefore, under the proposed model, they must share in the cost of the board. Next slide.
We have a question. Member Lacey.
Exactly how much do we cost the school district?
If you could be patient, I'll show you.
Okay.
Thank you. Then, on the next question, which, and it all kind of rolls towards a future slide, so please be patient. Regarding costs, it would be mandatory for charters. If we decide to move along with the changes proposed, are these costs based on negotiated agreements, and that's why they would, inserted, be mandated to use the district versus contracting out, or is it just common practice? Contracting for any services that are provided by district personnel, even for a charter school, is prohibited by state statute unless the union representing the employees who provide the service agree to a waiver. The school would be mandated to pay for certain services under the proposed funding only after a negotiation and agreement as to the level of service provided, unless the service is required for all schools, such as the Board of Education. And I do have examples to show you. If the costs from the question above are based on a district-wide student count, could it be said that charters would be then subsidizing other small schools? Costs are calculated on a district-wide basis, so the answer is no. It could be, however, argued that in some cases, the other schools may end up subsidizing some charter schools. Under the per-pupil allocation methodology, costs are shared district-wide. So if a charter school, for example, by nature of its configuration, is more expensive than some other school within the district, then by definition, under that model, they would be obtaining a subsidy. And I have an example to show you. Are all non-instruction services and jobs district-wide integrated into the negotiated agreements, or can any of them be contracted out? The answer is the same as previously. Contracting for services that are provided by district personnel, even for a charter school, is prohibited by state statute unless the union representing the employees who provide the service agree to a waiver. This is the only exception allowed by statute. If you want to continue with charter schools, there's just a couple more questions that aren't charter related. We could probably go through those and go back to the charter board's wish.
Are we near where Member Lacey's question is?
Yes.
It's yes. Ahead of us?
It is in front of you, yes. It'll be coming. Okay. Are there any directors in management positions being eliminated through the equity-based budget reductions? Yes, there have been some reductions of assistant principals. Formulas do not apply outside of the schools. So, outside of the formula, positions have been downgraded and based on the business process review have been eliminated. Next slide. This slide represents the different funding methodologies for the charter schools. So, if I may, in the column labeled A1, using current funding method total amount, I would like to point out that for purposes of example, I am using Birch Tree Charter School information. The board has been provided the entire worksheet for Birch Tree Charter. My rationale for using Birch Tree Charter as the sample is that Dr. McCauley was very helpful in working with us as we worked through the development of the model. And so I would like to recognize that she's been helpful in helping us kind of find errors so far, and we're working with all the charters collectively. But it was just the luck of the draw. She happened to be the first guinea pig, if you will. So column A1, this section of the worksheet says methodology reconciliation. What it attempts to do is to show you the funding under the three methods that we believe currently exist. Method A1 is the current funding methodology, where the borough contribution is provided to charter schools at the minimum required level by the state. Then the foundation formula is on a per student basis. That generates total revenue shown on line 9. We then apply an indirect rate of 0.5%. This is the amount which has been agreed to by the board verbally and which has been the past practice. That results in an indirect cost reimbursement deduction of, in this case, $12,150. The amount available, therefore, for discretionary expenditures is $305,324. When we get to a different section of the worksheet, I will explain what discretionary is versus other. Moving to column B1, using contractual funding, and notice in bold letters capitalized, will not be used. We are not proposing to go to the strict contract language, but this column represents what the contracts that you have with the charter schools say. Again, the borough funding would remain the same as in column A1. The state foundation formula is the same as column A1. However, the indirect rate that is applied is the indirect rate that has been certified by the state for this district, and it is 5.45%. Notice the deduction is, in this case, $132,432. So instead of having $305,324 available, they would only have $185,042 available. Again, we are not proposing this, but this is what's in the contract. Column C1 is the proposed new methodology. And under the proposed new methodology, the per pupil borough contribution is the same as it is for all other students. We take the total number of students in the district, divide it into the borough contribution, come up with the borough contribution amount, and that is what is represented on line 2. Notice it is substantially higher than the minimum required. The foundation funding is exactly the same. No indirect rate is applied. Why? We then charge for services, which I'll show you in a minute. So they start off with they start off with more money. Notice on line 9, the total of revenue under A1, the current, is $2,429,950. The current of revenue under C1 is $2,775,301. So therefore, they would have discretionary funds of $366,103, or an increase of $60,799 for Birch Tree Charter, given this configuration and proposal. If you move to the next slide, we then start to talk about expenditures. So if you look at column F, we start off and we say that for this school, you have non-discretionary expenditures, salaries, benefits, and they are paid by the district. In this school, they are $6,683.14 per student. The total cost, therefore, is $1,657,418. Their lease is per student $1,564.52. At this point, I'd like to take one step back, if I might, on the previous slide. I forgot to point out that there are other sources of revenue not currently listed here. Dr. Burnley was contacted by one of the assembly members about the possibility of an ordinance which would rebate the property tax paid by the landlord to the borough for these educational facilities, rebate that to the district. It was then that Dr. Burnley had a discussion. Do you want to take over?
Yes. The idea on the part of the borough is any charter school that is paying for a lease that once the taxes are charged to the owner, the lease money would be rebated back to the district and then asking us if we give that back directly to the schools. Now, the board doesn't have to do that, but we had a conversation. I think that's what I sense the board would want to do. So that's a plan in the works. It has to go through an ordinance. I'm not sure how far that's moved along.
Get to yours. Member Gaddis?
I think, Dr. Burnley, you may have misspoke. You said the lease money would be back. I think you meant the tax.
The tax.
Okay, just wanted to be clear.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
But that's paid by the charter school through their lease.
Correct. So
if they're leasing a building.
So if I hear you correctly, that tax money that the charter school paid will come back to the charter school.
Come to the district who has to rebate it to the charter school.
Got it.
Correct.
It will go back. It'll come through the district, but will go to that specific charter school in totality?
If that is the discretion of the board.
Discretionary, okay. Yes.
Have we approached Member Lacey's question of several minutes ago yet?
It's coming.
Okay.
Back to the next slide.
I guess there's a question from Member Gaddis.
Well, and just to be sure, that when you talked about the charter school monies coming in, did you include transportation dollars and food service dollars?
I have not. Let me explain why.
Okay.
But if I can keep going, I'll
you
get to that.
Because
I want to get
like
to the
good
end.
Book, and we want to get to the ending, but right. We'll do our best here.
Sorry. So we were explaining the non-discretionary expenditures. They are line 14, 15, and 16. And each school has these, and these are paid by the district or basically upfront. So you have lease and utilities. They aren't really available for that school. They're in their budget. They have to pay them, but they're not available for discretionary expenditures. The next area is instructional services, and there are a couple things I'd like to point out. One, you will see in the percent to be apportioned, you'll see on line 19, the very first one, it says zero. Well, Birch Tree Charter doesn't utilize career and technical education, so therefore no charge for that service.
Member Cordero.
Are any of the current schools using career and tech services currently?
No.
Okay, and how would that occur? What would be the service that they would get from career tech if they were to choose that?
Well, this appears on the list, and that would be a negotiated item.
Okay.
But it appears on the list because not only will the board see this for the charter schools, but when we move a little bit further down the budget process, you're going to see this same type sheet for every school.
Right.
You're going to be able to see the revenue that the school generated versus the expenditures. And there's a slightly different outcome at the end. But you'll be able to see that for every school. In addition,
right,
you'll see the staffing for every school.
Can you give me an example of a service? Sorry.
Specifically for CTE?
Yeah.
We've had a request from Twinley Bridge, mm-hmm, Charter School. Actually, they request quite a bit. We have a good exchange. For a student who's interested in welding to go into one of our programs and do welding. Next year, I think there's been a request already for a student to attend just part-time. I'm not exactly sure of the career pathway, just for 2 hours during the blocks at Career and Technical Ed to actually fulfill his education at CTE. However, the child currently goes to Twinley Bridge Charter School. And so there's also been special education requests from Twinley Bridge to take Read 180, which is a highly teacher-directed reading course. So we've had a couple of requests that we're working with Twinley Bridge in that. And generally, they're the only currently high school charter school. So many of the specialized programs at high school are difficult to deliver. Or they just want to offer more choices to their kids. So we have, you know, worked with the principal there to figure some things out to help their children.
Thank you. A question for Mr. Forrest. This formula that we see before us, you're saying this is the same formula that's applied to all of the schools?
Except that for all schools.
Except for correspondence or Mat-SU Central.
Mat-SU Central will also be calculated this way. But slightly differently.
Because of the 0.80.
Correct. The revenue is different, but also the expenditures will be slightly different. But for schools, all of these items are 100%. They don't get a choice because it's a district-wide. So all expenditures for district schools are 100%.
Well, okay. So, for example, when we look at the district-wide co-curricular events programs, we have a 5.80 figure there.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the same regardless of the school?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's a good example. If you look at that line, line 22, that is the cost per student district-wide. It's calculated that this school will use 5% of those services. In other words, in discussion with that principal, we arrived at a 5% use of that, and therefore the charge to that school is $71. Because you take the 5% times the number of kids, and that's what it costs.
And if they never, if they don't have no, theoretically, if they have no kids that are involved,
it would be zero.
And or so, prorated.
Or prorated. There are two ways in which we propose for them to pay for services. One is on the percentage, and the other is on a per cost basis. So let's say they don't want any professional development from instruction. We put a zero. But then later they change their mind and say, we want to send five people. Then they will receive a bill for the cost of those five people. And so they literally purchase the services they use.
Sorry. Go ahead. Just a question for everyone to understand. Why did administration decide to go this route?
Well, we haven't.
Well, work through this model. Why is this model before us to look at?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, I think in the end, charter schools are hit financially. We were making a minimal contribution. Instead, we're saying give the same contribution every other building gets. And if you see the net result of that, it's about $300,000. If you take those things into consideration, well, I also heard from some of the charter school principals worrying about where they were getting their fair share. And I think that further prompted our having this conversation. In fact, we have a couple of our charter school principals here. Perhaps they want to come.
I'm not Susan.
Okay, well, I know. Yeah, I thought it was Susan out there. Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I thought that's where you were.
Our principal
is
actually at information night for our school tonight.
Okay. So both from inquiries from the charter schools, are we getting our fair share? And then are taking a look at the model to see if, in fact, they were. I mean, I asked questions myself about we, for instance, were down to a district contribution of 0.5. I said, well, why are we doing that? Perhaps the district would be further or lesser ahead if we charge for services they use, which I think is a better way. So by the time we did the analysis, I think, as you can see up here, they're further ahead with this approach.
And so this model will be used for all schools?
Well, we're to the point we're recommending this to you and to them, and we can give them a choice.
Right, and can I address that?
But, I mean, for example, let's say Palmer High could have a similar categorical breakdown.
They will. There are differences.
Right.
We'll explain that in a future work session because they don't get any options.
Right. And so, for example, Trapper Creek, when we look at that, it will not look the same because we're providing a minimal program for them.
Right. And so what happens is when you look at Trapper Creek, for example, what happens is that it will show you the revenue that Trapper Creek generates. It will then show you the calculated cost per student as we go through the model. It will then show you the subsidy that Trapper Creek is receiving from the other schools in the district. Much the same as some schools generate more revenue, and therefore it shows the subsidy they are giving to the other schools.
This is really just an attempt to be, I don't want to use an overused term, transparent and understandable for the average person to take a look at principals, staff, charter school, committee members can take a look at, so there could be no accusation of favoritism or, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, Member Cordero, and then Member Larson.
I yield to Mr. Larson.
Member Larson.
A couple years ago on the board, we went through one heck of a presentation and debate with the charter schools. It was not a pretty situation. And at the time, their questions were what we got here for answers, but we didn't have that ability for one reason or another to articulate it. And I'm going to overuse your term again, transparency. It's all here. And we'll never have that discussion ever again with the principals and the staff and the parents that we had 2-3 years ago, which was, once again, it went on for a long time and it wasn't a pretty situation. And I yield to Member Welton.
Member Welton.
At the time, what you're speaking of is that they were saying they didn't get their share from the borough as a per pupil, and this is bringing that to the point that they would be getting their share. Am I right?
I think that's. Excuse me.
What I see is they're getting a choice, or they're seeing where the money is. It's all transparent up there. It's all up there in front. They're going to see what services they're going to pay for. They're going to see what they're going to get, and they're going to see if they get. And like you said, Dr. Burnley, they may end up with more funding on this. A fair, transparent way is what I see compared to what we dealt with a couple of years ago.
If Member Gaddis.
I just want to be sure. One of the things that I think is so exciting about charter schools is they have the opportunity to make their own choices. And I feel uncomfortable with this, and I may not understand it thoroughly, but it feels like there's not much a difference between our other schools and our charter schools. And quite frankly, that's the turnaround that I see that happens in education with our charter schools, is they can make and they can pick and choose and make those changes. And that's kind of my thought on that. The creativity is exciting. So unless I misunderstand, I'm hearing say that they really have no choice in many of these issues.
On the contrary. But I defer to...
Well, if you don't mind, let administration respond to that.
Okay. Well, first of all, Dr. McCauley, thank you for joining us. We looked and saw, well, there's Dr. McCauley, and then we said, oh, well, maybe that's not. So what's been attributed to you this evening while you were attending to your parents is how did you get to this point working up some formulas? I think I said, and Mr. Forrest said, well, because we had some principals of our charter schools inquiring as to whether they were getting their fair share. And as a result, we looked at these three options we're looking at now, and in one, we've determined that you were getting the minimal contribution from the borough as opposed to what everybody else was getting. And so then we've created the three formulas that you can see on the screen. And so the question was asked of us, how did you get there? And we thought we should defer to you. And then you just heard the recent question as to whether you really have any options with what we're presenting. Mm-hmm. So, Mr. President, we might hear from Dr. McCauley.
Sure.
President Birch Street Charter, rather, Principal
if
Birch
I,
Street Charter.
If I could first, I gave you full credit, Dr. McCauley, for being the guinea pig.
Oh,
since
okay.
you were so helpful the
that's
first
right.
time we met.
Member Gaddis, state statute provides for the kind of flexibility that you mentioned. The primary flexibility is with regard to curriculum and methods. But additionally, flexibility to spend our funds in the way that we, and not I, the APCs for our charter schools, deem most appropriate in order to meet the expectations that come with being a public school in Alaska. So, you know, one of the ways we have flexibility is certainly with regard to funding. We set our own PTR. We determine our own staffing. We make decisions about facilities. We determine professional development costs. And have a lot of autonomy there. So the initial conversation, it was correctly stated that it arose around the issue of borough revenue. And I, at the beginning of the year, had heard entirely contradictory pieces of information depending on with whom someone's talked in the community. And there is simply, in this case, a right and wrong answer. We either are or are not getting the full share of borough revenue. And so I really appreciate that the district has answered that question accurately and correctly and given us a solid answer, because I really didn't know what the answer was at the beginning of this school year.
Well, Principal McCauley, what is the answer?
The answer is that we are not. No, we're not getting, charter schools are not receiving the on a per pupil basis the full share of the borough revenue. State statute does not require that. That is at the discretion of every district's school board with regard to whether or not they provide that to charter schools. In this district, the past practice and current practice is that we are not receiving, when that borough revenue is considered on a per pupil basis, we are not receiving an equal share of that revenue. We are of state funding because that's required by state statute. So, as Mr. Forrest may have mentioned, we did submit a list of questions to Mr. Forrest today.
Yeah.
This afternoon. And so our next step, and by we I mean the six charter schools. So our job, the principal's job, is to do our best to provide information to our academic policy committees, because it is they who make these decisions. It is not the school principals. The contract, the charter, is between APCs and the school board. And so any adjustment or amendment to that contract, that decision is made by APCs. So our job right now, or what we perceive our job to be, is to do our very best in helping them understand a relatively complex budgeting possibility. So that's what we've been doing. And we've been working with them to have them tell us what their questions are. And so we submitted those questions today from all six charter schools. And so right now we're on a, you know, kind of fact-finding, getting our mind around this. It's a very different way of doing business. And we want to make a really responsible decision. And it's not just about next year. It's really about being able to determine impact, positive, negative, neutral in the long term for these schools. So we just right now want to be able to ask questions, hopefully get answers, and have some time to really, what's the word I'm looking for, digest this. So, but we're working on it daily, really. We're having conversations about it.
Member Cordero.
And Dr. McCauley actually covered part of what I wanted to ask, but Mr. Forrest, you had said that you had meetings with the principals to talk about these changes, but knowing how charter schools operate and that they go through their APCs, Susan, I don't mean to put you in a spotlight, but have you heard of the APCs, how they feel about this, about the changes proposed?
I feel only qualified to speak of my own, and they're more than capable of speaking themselves. Right. But they're reticent right now. It's just very different. We certainly like the transparency of the borough revenue piece of it. And certainly we like the fact that, at least in the short term, it results in more funding to the school. And not just more revenue. When the increased revenue, and when from that is subtracted the increased expenses, we still come out with more money in our budget next year, mm-hmm. Even though the expenses far exceed the state's maximum indirect rate of 5.4. 5.4 is about $180,000, if I remember correctly. I might not be entirely accurate on that.
Right.
And the at least initial look at the cost associated with this expense allocation model is in the neighborhood of $350,000. That's a very big difference. That's even, but when that increased revenue is given, we still come out with more money in our budget. So that's very appealing. The concern is being able to determine the long-range impact, and there are just a lot of variables here that we don't entirely yet understand, and we're not quite sure that we can predict where it might go. And some of the questions we submitted were along those lines today. So they're cautious. I guess that would be the best word I could use right now to describe their initial reaction is that they're cautious.
Cautiously optimistic, pessimistic, neither?
I think if I had to weigh on one side or the other, my guess is that they're going to want more time to research how this compares and contrasts, how state law, charter school law, compares and contrasts between Alaska and states that use this model, what other possible revenue and fee structures exist other than the three options identified here. I'm just not sure that we're going to be able to either independently come to some conclusions or through consultation with folks who have expertise in this area, be able to reach an informed decision by the end of this budgeting cycle.
Yeah. Mr. Forrest?
Stacy, could you go to slide 40? I have not talked to Dr. McCauley today. Please note the red area at the bottom of the slide. It says, if the level of concern continues, recommend using existing method for this budget year and forming a working group to evaluate an alternative funding proposal for FY13. So I sense that they're, not that they're being very cooperative. I think it's been very cooperative. I'm very appreciative of the help that they've given us. But I understand their concern and would say that if the uncertainty is a cause for concern as we move forward because of the planning that they all need to do for next year, perhaps we can get some guidance. And I have a couple other slides. I would like to propose something if I go through them, if that's okay.
Yes. Can I just ask the board a question? Are you folks interested in a five-minute break?
Yes.
If you don't mind. I'm going to recess for 5 minutes. I'm very sorry. Birch tree. We're helping the board understand where they're at in terms of their understanding of the new process that has been developed by administration for the purpose of understandability and transparency. So, Mr. Forrest or Dr. Burley, it's back to you.
Thank you. Well, I think the point's been made. It's not being imposed. If the APCs get together and want to go with one of the methods alternative to what's being done now, that's fine. For a year, we'll continue to talk. So this is just a way for us to show transparently how everything is funded, what the sources of the funds are, and decision-making can be moved to the next budget year, and we can use the same method we're using this year. Is there a timeline in terms of when you need to know?
Actually, There are a couple things if I could go through. The answer is yes, there is a timeline, Dr. Burnley, but I would like to just throw one more alternative, not to muddy the water, but there's a risk area I was just getting to that I wanted to bring up, if it's okay. And Lucy's here, so if I could, on slide 37, we've been going through some of the instructional service costs, and one of the things that is different about this model and does drive the cost up significantly is line 31. Line 31 is student support services. And as you'll notice, the per student cost for student support services is $2,225.07. In this example, you'll see that they are charged at 12%. So what we have done in this proposal for this methodology is to say that if they take this 12%, and how did we arrive at that? We took the number of their students that would qualify for special education services, so it's 12%. This line then says if they pay this amount, $66,218.08, if they pay this amount, then the district assumes the liability for providing special education services, regardless of the level of need, meaning the charter school benefits two ways. One, up above on line 14, they are currently paying for special education services, meaning if they have staff providing those services, they're paying for them. If they were to opt for line 31, then they would be relieved of that responsibility. This adds more discretionary dollars to their budget. This is one of the areas we're attempting to define and develop, both on our side and for them. The reason we are proposing this, and part of the reason we're proposing this methodology, goes back to our previous discussion about managing risk. It's difficult for a charter school to manage the risk associated with special education needs for students. One, they may have a student show up with severe needs. Their budget is somewhat limited and fixed. They literally may not have the resources to pay for those services, in which case we could be facing an issue of not allowing a student to enroll in a school which they would have the right to enroll in, opening us up to perhaps some legal action. Or the student is enrolled, they can't afford the appropriate level of service, and therefore, again, opening us up, but also perhaps providing less than adequate services to that student. What this line says is, by this insurance, is what I'm calling it, the district will assume all responsibility for servicing your special education students. We will provide, the district, will provide the resources to Lucy Hope and her team at the district level. Lucy and her team will then work with each school to provide the adequate level of staffing to meet the IEP needs, the individual educational program needs of each special education student. So, I believe that that is a better model for all concerned because it relieves a significant risk from each charter school. It relieves the district of risk, and it allows a continuity of program within special education for the entire district. So, and I'm doing this on the fly since I haven't had a chance to talk to Dr. Burnley. What I would propose is if we go to slide 41. Slide 41 is a summary of using the sample that we have here. It shows that under this new proposal, charter schools in general would receive an additional $422,000. That puts it almost in the middle of what the board
had the discussion about when we said $300,000 to $600,000 more may flow to the charter schools. What I would propose, and we'll still have to work some things out, would be at this point that we work with the charter schools to form a group, a working committee, if you will, to investigate fully vetting and coming up with a funding model that everyone agrees is adequate for next fiscal year. But utilize some of these dollars, which we have built into the budget already, to provide that special education insurance, if you will, to all of the charter schools in FY12.
I think let's leave this topic for a minute. I think Mr. Lacey's question deserves to be answered.
Actually, I answered my own question, but I do have a bit of a bother here. It says that we charge the charter school, this one, $20.77 for my breathing here. And it adds up to $5,150.96. I assume that's times, what, 43 schools? So that's a little over 200,000 and some change?
Yes.
How can we cost the school district 200,000 and some change? If sometime, not now, but sometime in the next couple, 3 weeks, I'd like to know just how, what we spend.
Sure. Absolutely.
Something that I can read easily.
We'll do that. Yes, sir.
Member Cordero.
Mr. President, information on the school board budget is page 247. 246 and 47 of tab reference number 4. And I was going
to repeat that,
about,
Member Cordero?
Page 246 and 247. This is just a school board budget. It says total school board budget, the proposed is $266,694. And I actually have some questions about this, but I was going to wait for later. Unless you think that I can ask them now.
Well, can I ask you to hold that?
Sure.
Because I want to make sure I want to capture something here
right.
in this discussion on charter schools, if it's okay.
Yeah.
This is a preliminary budget that we would either approve or not approve tonight. And I believe it's the board's understanding, and if there are members of the board that don't agree with what I'm about to say, please weigh in. As such, as a preliminary, it can be amended and changed as a result of discussions you're having with the charter schools, potentially, although you're looking at next year now, I think is what we're hearing. But either way, but also it's gonna, you're gonna come back to us when the revenue picture is much clearer. So this is to get this to the borough.
Yes.
Essentially.
Correct.
To meet a deadline.
Yes.
And then we will then get it back, and we'll have time throughout the spring to discuss this in more detail so that we can agree as a group to best allocate resources for next year.
Yes, sir.
That's correct.
And for the record, I was able to speak with Director DePriest for Career and Technical Education, and the request for career and technical classes in a large scale actually came from American Charter Academy. We do have 4 students at Twinley Bridge taking multiple classes, but in the interest of the students at American Charter for next year, they were requesting some spaces in some classes, and American Charter Academy is another charter school that services high schools, so I just wanted to make that correction.
Just a quick question, and this is a slightly unusual move, but since we have charter school folks here, just a quick question. From what you've heard and what you're working on, I know administration is working with administration, and the committees are working with their principal. But from what you've heard now, are you feeling a little more comfortable with the concept that we're going to continue to work together to make sure that we bring forth or produce a methodology in which the charter school funding is understandable and works? I rarely do that.
I feel, thus far, very good about the conversation, very good about the information, very good about the prospect that we are going to end up with something that we all understand and that we all agree is a more equitable and transparent way to go about funding charter schools, both the revenue and the fee side of it. So from a feeling perspective, I'm feeling fine about all of this so far and the direction that I've heard tonight that it's going to go, putting together a working group, giving us options, being willing to give us time, and very much so about the special education discussion, which in the whole scheme of things is currently my number one concern at Birchtree, with a 12% student population of students with IEPs. And Mr. Forrest articulated very well the ways that when a student population comes together, the results and the position charter schools are in of feeling that the right thing to do is to welcome students and to provide that option for parents, and then being in a position where we want to be able to be sure that we are meeting that child's needs, and that financially is very difficult sometimes.
I wish I had used the term belief.
Instead of feeling?
Yes.
Do I? So the answer is yes.
Thank
Either
you.
Way.
Question, Member Cordero.
Through the chair, Mr. Forrest, in a previous slide, you mentioned that all services provided had to, by statute, had to follow certain rules. And for a charter school to be able to contract out the services, they would need to get a waiver from the associations. Historically, do you know if that has happened with any of our charter schools? Have they requested a waiver, and has it been granted or not? Or maybe Jill or Rick can tell us if they know. Has this happened?
It's my understanding that no waivers have been requested.
Okay. Thank you.
Did you have a question? You had another question regarding school board budget, I believe.
Yeah, is it the right time to ask that now?
Mr. Forrest, would this – are we still in the
Good to go.
Okay. So I was when I was looking at the budget, and I think at our last work session you may have covered this, but just to be sure, line says 361 MEAS, insurance, life and health. It says for the current year, expenditures are $41,000. The adopted budget was zero, and then the revised budget is zero. Can you explain me why this is?
Nancy. Nancy Minos, our executives.
Yeah.
Nancy Cipinelli.
Thank you. yes. We have two different what we call object codes to track health insurance, health mm-hmm. and life insurance. We are insured through NEA Alaska Trust. However, there are two different plans. There's a separate plan for the teachers, which are the MSEA employees, and then there's another plan that covers all the rest of the employees. So to track those in the budget, we use two different object codes. We didn't start doing that until this fiscal year. So you'll see that in the budget for the school board, for object 371, it's insurance, health, and life, non-MSEA. That's where the insurance for the board is, the insurance budget.
And
so it was a change in the way that we classified the expenditure.
Is the 135 for insurance for the board, is that the full budget amount if all the board members were to accept that? Because I know I don't use the insurance because I have insurance through work. Or is this just for the amount of people who actually choose to be insured?
It's a budget for the anticipated usage for mm-hmm. the board because you don't have a policy per se. Mm-hmm. We're providing insurance coverage comparable to the insurance that's offered to the rest of the employees in the district. So it's difficult to really wrap a number per board member. Each board member has different insurance requirements and needs.
I'm sorry. How much does it cost per board member to be insured?
Per board member?
Yeah.
That I don't have that information.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the current policy, the NEA Trust, doesn't allow you to be under our insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a board policy that allows us to reimburse you for a separate insurance, which is handled through the risk manager.
Well, what I was getting at is that for those of us who choose not to be enrolled, perhaps that budgeted amount could go into the classrooms. I mean, I would advocate that my portion maybe can be allocated into a classroom or something else. And for those who choose to be enrolled, that they remain enrolled because, you know, it's a benefit for those board members.
Member Welton.
This came up when we talked with about insurance with our union people who didn't choose the higher-end insurance and stuff. What happens if one of us resigns and somebody comes in without any insurance? We would have to cover them. So it's a budgeted amount that at the end of the year goes into our fund, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it has to be there just in case.
Right.
Where are we, administration, in terms of your presentation?
We're finished with the presentation?
Yes, sir.
And we'd recommend the board have discussion, and we'd recommend adoption of this preliminary budget, which will change or certainly be brought back to you for final approval.
Okay. Is there a motion to move?
Public hearing first.
I'm sorry. Correct. Are there members of the public that would like to speak upon this item, which is, again, item B, 11-158 FY 2012 budget? If so, could you please come forward, state your name for the record? Seeing none, do we have a motion to move this item to the floor?
I make a motion we move this item to the floor.
Second.
The whole item. You need to state it. You're on the air.
I make a motion that we move item 11-15 fiscal year 2012 budget to the floor.
Second.
Seconded by Member Larson. Are there any? Member Welton.
If we're open for discussion, first off, I'd like to thank the administration for answering my questions. I know I gave you all a pile of them last Friday and did a very thorough job, and I appreciate the work that went into that. I have concerns concerning the subs, and if there's some way that we might be able to work on improving our subs and maybe doing some way to make it so that we get some money back out of that. If we have to put aside $1 million plus for absent days off, I realize that it's their right through contracts and things like this, you know, to take days off. And if somebody's sick, I don't want them in the classroom anyway. But if there's some way that we can improve the attendance, I think that would help us a little bit. I know $1 million is not a lot, but we're looking at 10 teachers. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the board? Comments? Member Cordero.
Well, first a comment. I also want to thank you and the staff for putting together the budget. It's very detailed. I have to say that I have a better understanding of this based on what you did this time, and I like the projections and that you took everything into consideration. It is not easy to approve a budget in which there will be layoffs that will affect the classrooms, because ultimately what we're doing here is to make sure that we are providing the best education that we can, but we also have to be conscious about that we have, you know, that we have limited resources and that we don't know what the income's going to look like. I do want to say that I would like to, I personally like this budget. I would like to hear from the advisory boards from the charter schools to see how they feel about this, but so far what you've presented here is good enough for me, and I will vote for this budget as proposed. Thank you.
Member Larson.
Yeah, a lot of my questions were answered through various calls, and I appreciate the answers that I got. And tonight was very enlightening. I just want to state that I agree with Eric over there on this. This budget is a sustainable budget. There is a couple other school boards that have voted on using their reserve. Of course, we can never use our reserve because we don't have a reserve. But they're using their reserve to prop up their budget. And virtually, if I can use your analysis, President Dunleavy, they're kicking the can down the road. And I see where this budget is not doing that. It is a sustainable budget and will be sustainable over a five-year period. And we're working on other issues within the budget to improve our revenue. So we're not kicking the can down the road anymore, which I think is tremendous. And I want to thank the administration, Ken Burnley and Ken Forrest, and their staff, Dr. Promo, for doing a tremendous job and a lot of work to do that and to be totally transparent as they're doing it.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the board before we vote? Member Gaddis.
I guess my comment is the fact that it's a preliminary budget, I'm comfortable voting yes on it, but I will say that there's a couple kinks and a couple questions that we still have to work out. Knowing that we have that opportunity, I'm in favor of this budget at this time.
I just have a commenter. So I want to thank administration for their hard work, for their detailed work. It helps us tremendously to understand the budget and to feel comfortable voting one way or another on the budget. I, too, appreciate the fact that this is a preliminary budget and has to meet certain deadlines to get to the borough. Appreciate the fact that we're going to have more discussion on the budget to work out some of these kinks or at least get our questions answered. I really appreciate the fact that administration is working with, for example, the nurse in the nurse's situation. Working with the folks closest to the issue to come up with solutions to these problems, I think, is a terrific approach, and I think it should be I would recommend it be continued. Appreciate the fact that Mr. Forrest is, in my opinion, bringing out the expertise that we knew we've always had here in the district in terms of the folks that he works with. And I think it's fantastic. Thank the charter school people for working with the administration to solve issues. We had consensus building here a couple days ago. I appreciate the union folks and others working with administration to solve issues. I think if we all work together, I think we're going to be able to solve issues. And so we're working on the legislative and lobbying end to help with this effort to ensure that we have some funding that will ensure that we have a program for our students that's going to be quality, because it's the goal of this borough school district to make this the best school district in the state of Alaska. We can't do it alone. So we appreciate the help with this. And the work is not over. We're just in the middle of it. Dr. Burnley?
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to thank the board. One, as we've met here this evening, we had your questions in advance. In most cases, that was very much appreciated. We had time to provide you thorough answers. I also want you to know that Mr. Forrest and his team, I'd ask them, those here from the, would you please stand? And Ken, kind of introduce them all, please stand. Everybody from the budget and finance office, please stand. And Ken, mention them one by one, if you will.
Sure. We have Terry Irwin, your Chief Financial Officer. Nancy Cipinelli, your Budget Officer. And Charity Little Phillips, who is our newest member to the budget team and really is much appreciated and has done a lot of work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And our presentations show the staff's performance. But what I want to make clear is none of this moves forward without my approval. So I constantly am meeting with Ken Forrest and his team. They don't move forward until I sign off, and that's very important because we don't ever want to pit Mr. Forrest against Dr. Paramo, which is the mission of the school district. Dr. Paramo, likewise, has a number of people here, and so any of these decisions and work you see, she's had a big hand in it, too. So I don't know the extent that you have staff here, but it's not coming from all from Ken Forrest, and it's very important that that not be the case, because we get into situations where I may have to make the call because I don't want to pit my staff against one another. So, Dr. Paramo, thank you, and thank every member of your team that's met with all the principals and helped establish the ratios. And so while instruction is important, we don't go anywhere without her involvement. So it's very important for everybody to know. Ken?
And I might add, that teamwork includes she proofed the slides for me today.
Thank you, Dr. Paramo, for that.
Yeah. So we appreciate it. And the fact that while you've set a very ambitious agenda for us, complete with metrics, timelines, and lots of transparency, we've also appreciated the fact that certainly in the last several months you've helped us focus on that, and that has meant a lot as opposed to giving us more things to do, because believe me, we are excited about the agenda, but it is an all-out effort on our part to keep up with it. So we appreciate you setting agenda and making us stick to it. Thank you.
Thank you. So on the floor, ready for vote, is 11-158 FY 2012 preliminary budget. Please, let's vote. Motion passes.
Oh, why don't you say it? Is it unanimous?
It's unanimous that the preliminary 2012 budget passes. Next item is item 5, executive session administration. Is there a...
No, there is not. Thank you very much.
We go on to item 6. Is there a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
I second it.
Any dissension? Thank you. Meeting is over. Thank you, public.